little too much cologne. But this man is mythic, the too shiny lead in a rom-com that has you shouting, "No dairy farmer has those abs." And he's smiling at me. Is this how it happens? Pick a small town, take a walk, meet an impossibly good-looking stranger? Were my exes onto something? His smile deepens, matching dimples, of course, as he nods and releases the door. And then I'm watching him through the window as he walks away, my heart whirring like an overheated laptop. When the stars in my eyes fade, I find myself not atop Mount Olympus, but in a coffee shop with exposed brick walls and old wooden floors, the smell of espresso thick in the air. At the back of the shop, a door opens onto a patio. The light streaming in hits a glass display case of pastries and plastic-wrapped sandwiches, and I basically hear angels singing. I get into line and scope out the crowd, a mix of hip, outdoorsy types in strappy hiking sandals and people in worn-out jeans and mesh-backed hats. Toward the front of the line, though, there's yet another good-looking man. Two in my first hour here, an exceptional ratio. He's not as striking as the door-holding Adonis, but good-looking in the way of a mere mortal, with coarse dark hair and a lean elegance. He's around my height, maybe a hair taller or shorter, dressed in a black sweatshirt whose sleeves are pushed up, and olive trousers with black shoes I have no choice but to describe as sexy. I can only see his face in profile, but it's a nice profile. Full lips, slightly jutted chin, sharp nose, eyebrows halfway between Cary Grant and Groucho Marx. Actually, he kind of looks like Charlie Lastra. Like, a lot like him. The man glances sidelong at the display case, and the thought pops across my brain like a series of bottle rockets. It's him! It's him! It's him! My stomach feels like someone tied it to a brick and threw it over a bridge. There's no way. It's weird enough that I'm here. There's no way he is, too. And yet, the longer I study him, the more unsure I am. Like when you think you spot a celebrity in person, but the longer you gawk, the more sure you become that you've never actually looked at Matthew Broderick's nose before, and for all you can remember, he might not have one at all. Or when you try to draw a car during a game of Pictionary and find out you have no idea what cars look like. The person at the front of the line pays, and the queue shifts forward, but I duck out, tucking myself on the far side of a bookshelf filled with board games. If it really is Charlie, it would be mortifying for him to see me hiding here, like seeing your stodgiest teacher outside a teens-only club while wearing a crop top and fake belly button ring. Not that I had that experience. I did. But if it's not, I can put this to rest easily. Maybe. I get out my phone and open my email app, searching his name. Aside from our first heated email exchange, there's only one more recent message from him. The mass email he sent with his new contact information when he moved from Wharton House to become an editor-at-large at Loja 6 months back. I tap out a quick email to the new address. Charlie, new manuscript in the works. Trying to recall, how do you feel about talking animals? Nora. It's not like I expect an out-of-office reply to detail where he's traveling or what precise coffee shop he's likely to be in, but at least I'll know if he's away from work. But my phone doesn't beep with an auto-reply. I peer around the shelf. The man, who may or may not be my professional nemesis, slides his phone from his pocket, head bowing and lips thinning into an unimpressed line. Only they're still too full, so basically he's pouting. He types for a minute, then puts his phone away. An honest-to-God chill slithers down my spine when my phone buzzes in my hand. It's a coincidence. It has to be. I open the reply. Nora. Terrified. Charlie. The queue moves forward again. He's next up to order. I don't have long to make my escape without being seen, with even less time to confirm or dispel my fears. Charlie, what about Bigfoot erotica? Have some queries in my slush pile. Good fit for you? Nora. As soon as I hit send, I snapped my senses. Why, of all the words available to me, is this what I said? Maybe my brain is organized by the Dewey Decimal System, but right now all the shelves seem to be on fire. Embarrassment courses through my veins at the sudden image of Charlie opening that email and instantly gaining the professional high ground. The man pulls his phone out. The teenage boy in front of him has just finished paying. The barista summons Maybe Charlie forward with a cheery smile, but he mumbles something and steps out of line. He's halfway facing me now. He gives his head a firm shake, the corner of his mouth twisting into a grimace. It's got to be him. I'm sure of it now, but if I run for the door, I'll only draw his eye. What could he possibly be doing here? My middle-class party trick tallies him up from head to toe. $500 of neutral tones. But if he was going for camouflage, it's not working. He might as well be standing under a movie theater marquee advertising The Out-of-Towner with an arrow pointed straight at his peppery hair. I face the bookshelf, putting my back to him and pretending to peruse the games. Considering how short, not to mention asinine, my message was, he takes a surprisingly long time to reply. Of course, he could be reading any number of emails other than mine. I nearly drop my phone in my frenzy to open the next message. No firm opinions as of yet, but extreme curiosity. Feel free to forward to me. I check over my shoulder. Charlie has rejoined the queue. How many times can I keep making him get out of line? I wonder with a thrill. I understand being glued to your phone when it comes to important work-related things, but I'm surprised the instinct runs so deep that he thinks a message about Bigfoot erotica requires an immediate response. I do actually have a Bigfoot erotica submission in my inbox. Sometimes when my boss is having a rocky day, I'll do a dramatic reading from Bigfoot's Big Feet to cheer her up. It would be unethical to share the manuscript outside the agency. But the author actually included a link to his website, where a handful of self-published novellas are available for purchase. I copy the link to one and send it to Charlie without context. I glance back to see him scowling down at his phone. A reply buzzes in. This costs 99 cents. I reply, I know, such a bargain. If my professionalism is a gel manicure, then Charlie Lastra is apparently the industrial-grade acetone capable of burning right through it. I search his name on Venmo and send him 99 cents. Another email comes in a second later. He sent the dollar back to me with the note, I'm a grown man, Nora. I can buy my own Bigfoot erotica. Thank you very much. The cashier greets him again, and this time he shoves his phone into his pocket and steps up to order. While he's distracted, I take my chance. I am famished. I am desperate to know what he's doing here, and I am half running toward the door.
No freaking way, Libby cries.
We're sitting at the rough-hewn wooden table in the cottage, devouring the breadsticks and salads we ordered from Antonio's Pizza. I had to trek back down to the mailbox to collect the order when the delivery guy said he wasn't allowed to climb the stairs for insurance reasons. Sounds made up, but okay.
The guy who was so rude about Dusty's book?
Libby clarifies. I nod and stab a surprisingly juicy tomato in the salad, popping it into my mouth.
What's he doing here? She asks.
I don't know.
Oh my gosh, she says. What if he's a once-in-a-lifetime superfan?
I snort. I think that's the one possibility we can rule out.
Maybe he's like Old Man Whittaker in Once, just afraid to show his true feelings. Secretly, he loves this town, and the book, and the widowed Mrs. Wilder.
I'm actually unbearably curious, but we're not going to solve the mystery by guessing. What do you want to do tonight?
Shall we consult the list?
She digs the sheet out of her bag and smooths it on the table.
Okay, I'm too tired for any of this.
Too tired? I say. To pet a horse and save a local business? Even after your nap?
You think 40 minutes is enough to make up for the 3 weeks of Bee crawling into bed with us after a nightmare?
I wince. Those girls must have an internal body temperature of at least 300 degrees. You can't sleep next to them without waking up drenched in sweat with a tiny, adorable foot digging into your ribcage. You need a bigger bed, I tell Libby, pulling my phone out to start the search.
Oh, please, Libby says. We can't fit a bigger bed in that room. Not if we plan on ever opening our dresser drawers.
I feel a spark of relief right then, because the change in Libby, the fatigue, the strange, intangible distance, suddenly makes sense. It has a cause, which means it has a solution. You need a bigger place, especially with baby number 3 on the way. One bathroom for a family of 5 is my idea of purgatory.
We couldn't afford a bigger place if it were parked on top of a trash barge 45 minutes into Jersey, Libby says. Last time I looked at apartment listings, everything was like one bedroom, zero bath, crawl space inside a serial killer's wall. Utilities included, but you provide the victims. And even that was outside our price range.
I wave a hand. Don't worry about the money. I can help out. She rolls her eyes.
I don't need your help. I am a whole adult woman. All I need is a night in, followed by a month of rest and relaxation, okay?
She's always hated taking money from me, but the whole reason to have money is to take care of us. If she won't accept another loan, then I'll just have to find her an apartment she can afford. Problem halfway solved. Fine, I say. We'll stay in. Hepburn night? She gives a genuine grin.
Hepburn night.
Whenever Mom was stressed or heartbroken, she used to allow herself one night to lean into that feeling. She'd call it a Hepburn night. She loved Hepburn. Catherine, not Audrey. Not that she had anything against Audrey. That's how I wound up with the name Nora Catherine Stevens, while Libby got Elizabeth Baby Stevens, the baby part being after the leopard in Bringing Up Baby. On Hepburn nights, the three of us would each pick out one of Mom's over-the-top vintage robes and curl up in front of the TV with a root beer float and a pizza, or decaf and chocolate pie, and watch an old black-and-white movie. Mom would cry during her favorite scenes, and when Libby or I caught her, she'd laugh, wiping away her tears with the back of one hand and say, "I'm such a softie." I loved those nights. They taught me that heartbreak, like most things, was a solvable puzzle. A checklist could guide a person through mourning. There was an actionable plan for moving on. Mom mastered that, but never quite got to the next step, weeding out the assholes. Married men. Men who didn't want to be stepfathers. Men who had absolutely no money, or who had lots of money and family members all too willing to whisper gold digger. Men who didn't understand her aspirations to be on stage, and men who were too insecure to share the spotlight. She was saddled with kids when she was little more than one herself, but even after everything she went through, she kept her heart open. She was an optimist and a romantic, just like Libby. I expected my sister to fall in love a dozen times over, be swept off her feet over and over again for decades, but instead, she fell in love with Brendan at 20 and settled down. I, meanwhile, had approximately one romantic bone in my body, and once it shattered and I pinned myself back together, I developed a rigorous vetting process for dating. So neither Libby nor I have need for our old-fashioned Hepburn nights. Now they're an excuse to be lazy and a way to feel close to Mom. It's only 6 o'clock. But we change into our pajamas, including our silk robes. We drag the blankets off the bed in the loft and down the iron spiral staircase to the couch and pop in the first DVD from the Best of Katharine Hepburn box set Libby brought with her. I find two speckled blue mugs in the cabinet and put the kettle on for tea, and then we sink into the couch to watch Philadelphia Story, matching charcoal sheet masks plastered to our faces. My sister's head drops against my shoulder, and she heaves a happy sigh.
"This was a good idea," she says.
My heart twinges. In a few hours, when I'm lying in an unfamiliar bed, sleep nowhere to be found, or tomorrow, when Libby sees the lackluster town square for the first time, my feelings might change, but right now, all is right in the world. Anything broken can be fixed. Any problem can be solved. When she drifts off, I pull my phone from my robe and type out an email, BCCing every real estate agent, landlord, and building manager I know. You are in control, I tell myself. You won't let anything bad happen to her ever again. My phone chirps with a new email around 10 p.m. Ever since Libby shuffled up to bed an hour ago, I've been sitting on the back deck, willing myself to feel tired and nursing a glass of the velvety Pinot Sally Good, the cottage's owner, left for us. At home, I'm a night owl. When I'm away, I'm more like an insomniac who just mixed a bunch of cocaine into some Red Bull and took a spin on a mechanical bull. I tried to work, but the Wi-Fi's so bad that my laptop is a glorified paperweight, so instead I've been staring into the dark woods beyond the deck, watching fireflies pop in and out of view. I'm hoping to find a message from one of the real estate agents I reached out to. Instead, Charlie Lastra is bolded at the top of my inbox. I tap the message open and barely avoid a spit take. I would have preferred to go my whole life without knowing this book existed, Stevens. Even to my own ears, my cackle sounds like an evil stepmother. You bought the Bigfoot erotica? Charlie replies, business expense. Please tell me you charged it to a Loja credit card. This one takes place at Christmas, he writes. There's one for every holiday. I take another sip, contemplating my reply. Possibly something like, drink any interesting coffee lately? Maybe Libby's right. Maybe Charlie Lastra was secretly as charmed as the rest of America by Dusty's portrayal of Sunshine Falls and planned a visit during publishing's annual late summer hibernation. I can't bring myself to broach the subject. Instead, I write, what page are you on? 3, he says, and I already need an exorcism. Yes, but that has nothing to do with the book. Again, as soon as I've sent it, I have to marvel/panic at my own unprofessionalism. Over the years, I've developed a finely tuned filter, with pretty much everyone except Libby, but Charlie always manages to disarm it, to press the exact right button to open the gate and let my thoughts charge out like velociraptors. For example, when Charlie replies, I'll admit it's a masterclass in pacing, otherwise I remain unimpressed. My instant reaction is to type, otherwise I remain unimpressed is what they'll put on your headstone. I don't even have the thought I shouldn't send this until I already have. On yours, he replies, they'll put, here lies Nora Stevens, whose taste was often exceptional and occasionally disturbing. Don't judge me based on the Christmas novella, I reply. I haven't read it. Would never judge you on Bigfoot porn, Charlie says. Would entirely judge you for preferring Once in a Lifetime to the Glory of Small Things. The wine has slipped one Jenga piece too many loose from my brain. I write, it's not a bad book. It's not a bad book, Nora Stevens, Charlie replies. I think I remember seeing that endorsement on the cover. Admit you don't think it's bad, I demand. Only if you admit you don't think it's her best either, he says. I stare at the screen's harsh glow. Moths keep darting in front of it, and in the woods I can hear cicadas humming, an owl hooting. The air is sticky and hot, even this long after the sun has sunk behind the trees. Dusty is so ridiculously talented. I type. She's incapable of writing a bad book. I think for a moment before continuing. I've worked with her for years, and she does best with positive reinforcement. I don't concern myself with what's not working in her books. I focus on what she's great at. Which is how Dusty's editor was able to take once from good to outrageously unputdownable. That's the thing that makes working on a book exciting, seeing its raw potential, knowing what it's trying to become. Charlie replies, says the woman they call the shark. I scoff. No one calls me that. I don't think. Says the man they call the storm cloud. Do they? He asks. Sometimes, I write. Of course, I would never. I'm far too polite. Of course, he says. That's what sharks are known for. Manners. I'm too curious to let it go. Do they really call me that? Editors, he writes back, are terrified of you. Not so scared they won't buy my author's books, I counter. So scared they wouldn't if the books were any less fucking fantastic. My cheeks warm with pride. It's not like I wrote the books he's talking about. All I do is recognize them and make editorial suggestions and figure out which editors to send them to and negotiate the contract so the author gets the best deal possible and hold the author's hand when they get edit letters the size of Tolstoy novels and talk them down when they call me crying, etc. Do you think, I type back, it has anything to do with my tiny eyes and gigantic gray head? Then I shoot off another email clarifying, the nickname, I mean. Pretty sure it's your bloodlust, he says. I huff. I wouldn't call it bloodlust. I don't revel in exsanguination. I do it for my clients. Sure. I have some clients who are sharks themselves, eager to fire off accusatory emails when they feel neglected by their publishers, but most of them are more likely to get steamrolled or to keep their complaints to themselves until their resentment boils over and they self-destruct in spectacular fashion. This might be the first I'm hearing of my nickname, but Amy, my boss, calls my agenting approach smiling with knives, so it's not a total shock. They're lucky to have you, Charlie writes. Dusty especially. Anyone who'd go to bat for a not bad book is a saint. Indignation flames through me. And anyone who'd miss that book's obvious potential is arguably incompetent. For the first time, he doesn't respond right away. I tip my head back, groaning at the alarmingly starry. Is this the first time I've looked up sky as I try to figure out how, or whether, to backtrack? A prick draws my gaze to my thigh, and I slap away a mosquito, only to catch two more landing on my arm. Gross. I fold up my laptop and carry it inside, along with my books, phone, and mostly empty wine glass. As I'm tidying up, my phone pings with Charlie's reply. It wasn't personal, he says. Then another message comes in. I've been known to be too blunt. Apparently, I don't make the best first impression. And I reply, am actually known to be very punctual. You caught me on a bad day. What do you mean? He asks. That lunch, I say. That was how it all started, wasn't it? I was late, so he was rude, so I was rude back, so he hated me, so I hated him, and so on and so forth. He doesn't need to know I'd just gotten dumped in a 4-minute phone call, but it seems worth mentioning those were extenuating circumstances. I'd just gotten some bad news. That's why I was late. He doesn't reply for a full 5 minutes. Which is annoying because I'm not in the habit of having real-time conversations over email, and of course he could just stop replying at any moment and go to bed while I'll still be here staring at a wall wide awake. If I had my Peloton, I could burn off some of this energy. I didn't care that you were late, he says finally. You looked at your watch pointedly, I write back, and said, if I recall, you're late. I was trying to figure out if I could catch a flight, Charlie replies. Did you make it? I ask. No, he says. Got distracted by two gin martinis and a platinum blonde shark who wanted me dead. Not dead, I say. Lightly mauled, maybe, but I would have stayed away from your face. Didn't realize you were a fan, he writes. A zing goes down my spine and right back up it, like my top vertebrae just touched a live wire. Is he flirting? Am I? I'm bored, yes, but not that bored. Never that bored. I deflect with, just trying to watch out for your eyebrows. If anything happened to those things, it would change your entire stormy scowl and you'd need a new nickname. If I lost my eyebrows, he says, somehow I think there would be no shortage of new nicknames available to me. I'm guessing you'd have some suggestions. I'd need time to think, I say. Wouldn't want to make any rash decisions. No, of course not, he replies. Seconds later, another line follows. I'll let you get back to your night. And you to your Bigfoot novella, I type. Then backspace, and force myself to leave the message unanswered. I shake my head, trying to clear the image of growly Charlie Lastra scowling at his e-reader in a hotel somewhere nearby, his frown deepening whenever he reaches something salacious. But that image, it seems, is all my brain wants to dwell on. Tonight, when I'm lying in bed, wide awake and trying to convince myself the world won't end if I drift off, this is what I'll come back to. My own mental happy place. 4. I wake, heart racing, skin cold and damp. My eyes snap open on a dark room, jumping from an unfamiliar door to the outline of a window to the snoring lump beside me. Libby. The relief is intense and immediate. An ice bucket dumped over me all at once. The whirring of my heart starts its signature post-nightmare cooldown. Libby is here. Everything must be okay. I piece together my surroundings. Goods Lily Cottage, Sunshine Falls, North Carolina. It was only the nightmare. Maybe nightmare isn't the right word. The dream itself is nice, until the end. It starts with me and Libby coming into the old apartment, setting down keys and bags. Sometimes Bea and Tala are with us, or Brendan, smiling good-naturedly while we fill up every gap with frantic chatter. This time, it's just the two of us. We're laughing about something, a play we just saw, Newsies maybe. From dream to dream, those details change, and as soon as I sit up, breathing hard in the dark of this unfamiliar room, they fritter off like petals on a breeze. What remains is the deep ache, the yawning canyon. The dream goes like this. Libby tosses her keys into the bowl by the door. Mom looks up from the table in the kitchenette, legs curled under her, nightgown pulled over them. Hey, Mama, Libby says, walking right past her toward our room, the one we shared when we were kids. My sweet girls, Mom cries, and I bend to sweep a kiss across her cheek on my way to the fridge. I make it all the way there before the chill sets in, the feeling of wrongness. I turn and look at her, my beautiful mother. She's gone back to reading, but when she catches me staring, she breaks into a puzzled smile. What? I feel tears in my eyes. That should be the first sign that I'm dreaming. I never cry in real life, but I never noticed this incongruity. She looks the same, not a day older, like springtime incarnate, the kind of warmth your skin gulps down after a long winter. She doesn't seem surprised to see us, only amused, and then concerned. Nora? I go toward her, wrap my arms around her, and hold tight. She circles me in hers, too, her lemon lavender scent settling over me like a blanket. Her glossy strawberry waves fall across my shoulders as she runs a hand over the back of my head. Hey, sweet girl, she says. What's wrong? Let it out. she doesn't remember that she's gone. I'm the only one who knows she doesn't belong. We walked in the door, and she was there, and it felt so right, so natural, that none of us noticed it right away. I'll make tea, Mom says, wiping my tears away. She stands and walks past me, and I know before I turn that when I do, she won't be there anymore. I let her out of my sight, and now she's gone. I can never stop myself from looking, from turning to the quiet, still room, feeling that painful emptiness in my chest like she's been carved out of me. And that's when I wake up. Like if she can't be there, there's no point in dreaming at all. I check the alarm clock on the bedside table. It's not quite 6, and I didn't fall asleep until after 3. Even with my sister's snores shivering through the bed, the house was too quiet. Crickets chirped and cicadas sang in a steady rhythm, but I missed the one-off honk of an annoyed cab driver or the sirens of a fire truck rushing past. Even the drunk guys shouting from opposite sides of the street as they headed home after a night of bar hopping. Eventually, I downloaded an app that plays cityscape sounds and set it in the windowsill, turning it up slowly so it wouldn't jar Libby awake. Only once I'd reached full volume did I drift off. But I'm wide awake now. My pang of homesickness for my mother rapidly shapeshifts into longing for my Peloton. I am a parody of myself. I pull on a sports bra and leggings and trip downstairs, then tug on my sneakers and step out into the cool darkness of morning. Mist hovers across the meadow, and in the distance, through the trees, the first sprays of purpley pink stretch along the horizon. As I cross the dewy grass toward the footbridge, I lift my arms over my head, stretching to each side before picking up my pace. On the far side of the footbridge, the path winds into the woods, and I break into an easy jog, the air's moisture pooling in all my creases. Gradually, the post-dream ache starts to ease. Sometimes it feels like no matter how many years pass, when I first wake up, I'm newly orphaned. Technically, I guess we're not orphans. When Libby got pregnant the first time, she and Brendan hired a private investigator to find our father. When he did, Libby mailed dear old Dad a baby shower invitation. She never heard back, of course. I don't know what she expected from a man who couldn't be bothered to show up to his own kid's birth. He left Mom when she was pregnant with Libby, without so much as a note. Sure, he also left a $10,000 check, but to hear Mom tell it, he came from so much money that that was his idea of petty change. They'd been high school sweethearts. She was a sheltered, homeschooled girl with no money and dreams of moving to New York to become an actress. He was the wealthy prep school boy who impregnated her at 17. His parents wanted Mom to terminate the pregnancy. Hers wanted them to get married. They compromised by doing neither. When they moved in together, both sets of parents cut them off, but his turned over his inheritance as a parting gift, a sliver of which he'd bequeathed to us on his way out the door. She used the nest egg to move us from Philly to New York and never looked back. I push the thoughts away and lose myself in the delicious burn of my muscles, the thudding of my feet against pine needle dusted earth. The only two ways I've ever managed to get out of my head are through reading and rigorous exercise. With either, I can slip out of my mind and drift in this bodiless dark. The trail curves down a forested hillside, then turns to follow a split rail fence, beyond which a pasture stretches out, glowing in the first spears of light, the horses dotting the field backlit, their tails swishing at the gnats and flies that float and glimmer in the air like gold dust. There's a man out there, too. When he sees me, he lifts a hand in greeting. I squint against the fierce light, my stomach rising as I place him as the coffee shop Adonis, the small-town leading man. Do I slow down? Is he going to come over here? Should I call out and introduce myself? Instead, I choose a fourth option. I trip over a root and go sprawling in the mud, my hand landing squarely in something that appears to be poop. A lot of it. Like, maybe a whole family of deer has specifically marked this spot as their shit palace. I clamber onto my feet, gaze snapping toward romance novel hero, to find that he's missed my dramatic performance. He's looking at, talking to, one of the horses. For a second, I contemplate calling out to him. I play the fantasy out to its logical conclusion, this gloriously handsome man reaching to shake my hand, only to find my palm thoroughly smeared with deer pellets. I shudder and turn down the path, picking up my jog. If, eventually, I meet the exceptionally handsome horse whisperer, then great, maybe I can make progress on the list and check off number 5. If not, well, at least I have my dignity. I brush a strand of hair out of my face, only to realize I've used the scat hand. Scratch that part about dignity.
I forgot how peaceful it is grocery shopping without a 4-year-old, like, lying on the ground and licking the tile.
Libby sighs, moseying down the toiletries aisle like an aristocrat taking a turn about the garden in Regency-era England.
And all the space, I say,
far more enthusiastically than I feel. I've been able to forestall Libby seeing the droopy city center of Sunshine Falls by insisting on having Hardy drive us to the Publix a few towns over, but I'm still in preemptive damage control mode, as evidenced by the 15 minutes I spent pointing out various trees on the ride over. Libby stops in front of the boxed dyes, a brilliant smile overtaking her face.
Hey, we should choose each other's makeover looks. Like, hair color and cut, I mean.
I'm not cutting my hair, I say.
Of course you're not, she says. I am.
Actually, you're not.
She frowns. It's on the list, sissy, she says. How else are we supposed to transform via montage into our new selves? It'll be fine. I cut the girl's hair all the time.
That explains Tala's Dorothy Hamill phase. Libby smacks me in the boob, which is completely unfair because you can't hit a pregnant lady's boob, even if she's your little sister.
Do you really have the emotional resilience to leave a checklist unchecked? She says.
Something in me twitches. I really do fucking love a checklist. She pokes me in the ribs.
Come on, live a little. This will be fun. It's why we're here.
It is decidedly not why I'm here, but the reason I'm here is standing right in front of me, a melodramatic lower lip jutted out, and all I can think about is the month ahead of us, marooned in a town that's nothing like the one she's expecting. And even aside from that, historically, Libby's crises can be tracked by dramatic changes in appearance. As a kid, she never changed her hair color. Mom made a big deal about how rare and striking Lib's strawberry blonde waves were, but Libby showed up to her own wedding with a pixie cut she hadn't had the night before. A couple days later, she finally opened up to me about it, admitted she'd had a burst of cold feet bordering on terror and needed to make another dramatic, though less permanent, decision to work through it. I personally would have gone with a color-coded pro-con list, but to each her own. The point is, Libby's clearly reckoning with the arrival of this new baby and what it will mean for her and Brendan's already strained finances and tight quarters. If I push her to talk about it now, she'll clam up. But if I write it out with her, she'll talk about it when she's ready. That aching, pulsing space between us will be sealed shut, a phantom limb made whole again. That's why I'm here. That's what I want. Badly enough that I'll shave my head if that's what it takes, then order a very expensive wig. Okay, I relent. Let's get made over. Libby lets out a squeal of happiness and pushes up on her tiptoes to kiss my forehead.
I know exactly what color you're getting, she says. Now turn around and don't peek.
I make a mental note to schedule a hair appointment for the day I fly home to New York. By the time we return to the cottage that afternoon, the sun is high in the cloudless blue sky, and as we hike the hillside, sweat gathers in every inconvenient place. But Libby chatters along, unbothered.
"I'm so curious what color you picked for me," she says.
"No color," I reply. "We're just going to shave your head." She squints through the light, her freckled nose wrinkling.
"When will you learn that you're so bad at lying that it's not worth even trying?"
Inside, she sits me down in a kitchen chair and slathers my hair in dye. Then I do the same, neither of us showing our hand. At the time, I felt so confident in my choice, but seeing how eye-burningly vibrant the color looks caked over her head, I'm less sure. Once our timers are set, Libby starts on brunch. She's been a vegetarian since she was little, and after Mom died, I became one too by default. Financially, it didn't make sense to buy two different versions of everything. Also, meat's expensive. From a purely mathematical standpoint, vegetarianism made sense for two newly orphaned girls of 20 and 16. Even after Libby moved in with Brendan, it stuck. During her aspiring chef phase, she won him over to a plant-based diet. So while it's tempeh frying in the pan beside the eggs she's scrambling for us, it smells like bacon. Or at least enough like bacon to appeal to someone who hasn't had the real thing in 10 years. When the timer goes off, Libby shoos me off to rinse, warning me not to look in the mirror or else. Because I'm so bad at lying, I follow her orders, then take over the job of transferring brunch into the oven to keep warm while she rinses her dye. With her hair wrapped in a towel, she takes me onto the deck to trim mine. Every few seconds, she makes an inauspicious, huh, sound.
"Really instilling confidence in me, Libby," I say.
She snips some more at the front of my face.
"It's going to be fine."
It sounds a little too much like she's giving herself a pep talk for my liking. After I've chopped her hair into a long bob, most of it air-dried by now, we go inside for the big reveal. After matching deep breaths, preparing our egos for a humbling, we step in front of the bathroom mirror together and take it in. She's given me feathery bangs somewhere between fringe and curtain, and somehow they make the ash brown color read more Laurel Canyon free spirit than dirty dishwater.
"You really are sickeningly good at everything. You know that, right?" I say.
Libby doesn't reply, and when my gaze cuts toward hers, a weight plummets through me. She's staring at the reflection of her Pepto-Bismol pink waves with tears welling in her eyes. Shit. A huge and obvious misfire. Libby may generally favor a bold look, but I forgot to factor in how pregnancy tends to affect her self-image.
"It'll start rinsing out in a few washes," I say. "Or we can go back to the store and get a different color. Or find a good salon in Asheville, my treat. Really, this is an easy fix, Lib."
The tears are reaching their breaking point now, ready to fall.
"I just remembered you begging Mom to let you get pink hair when you were in 9th grade, I go on. "Remember? She wouldn't let you and you went on that hunger strike until she said you could do dip dye?"
Libby turns to me, lip quivering. I have a split second to wonder if she's about to attack me before her arms fling around my neck, her face burying into the side of my head.
"I love it, sissy," she says,
her sweet lemon lavender scent engulfing me. The roaring panic storm settles in me. The tension dissolves from my shoulders.
"I'm so glad," I say, hugging her back. "And you really did an amazing job. I mean, I'm not sure what would ever possess a person to choose this color, but you made it work."
She pulls back, frowning.
"It's as close to your natural color as I could find. I always loved your hair when we were kids."
My heart squeezes tight, the back of my nose tingling like there's too much of something building in my skull and it's starting to seep out.
"Oh no," she says, looking back into the mirror. "It just occurred to me. What am I supposed to say when Bee and Tala ask to dye theirs into unicorn tails or shave their heads entirely?
You say no, I say. And then, the next time I'm babysitting, I'll hand over the dye and clippers. Afterward, I'll teach them how to roll a joint, like the sexy, cool, fun aunt I am.
Libby snorts. You wish you knew how to roll a joint. God, I miss weed. The maternity books never prepare you for how badly you're going to miss weed.
Sounds like there's a hole in the market, I say. I'll keep an eye out.
The Pothead's Guide to Pregnancy, Libby says.
Marijuana Mommy, I reply.
And its companion, Doobie Daddies.
You know, I say, if you ever need to complain about your lack of weed or pregnancy or anything else, I'm here. Always.
Yep,
she says, eyes back on her reflection, fingers back in her hair.
I know.
5. My phone buzzes with an incoming email, and Charlie's name is bolded across the screen. The words, distracted by 2 gin martinis and a platinum blonde shark, flash across my mind like a casino's neon sign. Part thrill, part warning. I don't want my work email to get flagged, but there are so many excerpts of this book I can't unread. I'm in a horror movie, and I won't be freed of this curse until I've inflicted it on someone else. Technically, Charlie already has my phone number from my email signature. The question is whether to invite him to use it. Pro? Maybe there'd be a natural opening to mention I'm in Sunshine Falls, thus lowering the risk of an awkward run-in. Con? Do I really want my professional nemesis texting me Bigfoot erotica? Pro? Yes, I do. I'm curious by nature, and at least this way, the exchange of information is happening over private channels rather than professional ones. I type out my phone number and hit send. By then, it's time for my check-in call with Dusty, a 20-minute conversation that might as well just be me playing jock jams and running circles around her, chanting her name. I throw the word genius out a half dozen times, and by the time we hang up, I've convinced her to turn in the first chunk of her next book, even if it's rough, so her editor, Sharon, can get started while Dusty finishes writing. Afterward, I rejoin Libby where she's primping in the bathroom, curling her freshly pink hair into soft ringlets.
Let's walk to dinner, she says. My neck is sore from that last cab ride. Also, it made me pee myself.
I remember, I say. It made you pee me, too. She glances over my outfit.
You sure you want to wear those shoes?
I've paired my black backless sheath with black mules, my whitest heels. She's in a daisy print sundress from the 90s and white sandals. If you offer to lend me your Crocs again, I'm going to sue you for emotional damages. She balks.
After that comment, you don't deserve my Crocs.
On the hike down the hillside, I attempt to hide my struggle, but based on Libby's gleeful smirk, she definitely notices that my heels keep puncturing the grass and spiking me into place. The sun has gone down, but it's still oppressively hot, and the mosquito population is raging. I'm used to rats. Most run away at the sight of a person, and the rest basically just hold out tiny hats to beg for bits of pizza. Mosquitoes are worse. I've got 6 new red welts by the time we reach the edge of the town square. Libby hasn't gotten bitten once. She bats her lashes.
I must be too sweet for them.
Or maybe you're pregnant with the Antichrist and they recognize you as their queen. She nods thoughtfully.
I could use the excitement, I guess.
She pauses at the very empty crosswalk and scans the equally desolate city center, her mouth shrinking as she considers it.
Huh,
she says finally.
It's sleepier than I expected.
Sleepy is good, right? I say, a bit too eagerly. Sleepy means relaxing.
Right.
She sort of shakes herself, and her smile returns.
Exactly. That's why we're here.
She looks more quizzical than devastated when we pass the general store-turned-pawn shop, and I make a big deal of pointing out mug and shot to distract her.
"It smelled amazing," I insist. "We'll have to go tomorrow."
She brightens further, like she's on a dimmer switch powered by my optimism, and if that's the case, I'm prepared to be optimistic as hell. Next, we pass a beauty parlor.
"Okay, definitely should have just gotten our hair cut here," Libby says, though I silently disagree,
based on the dripping blood-style letters on the sign and the fact that they spell out "curl up and die." After a couple more empty storefronts, there's a greasy spoon diner, another dive bar, and a bookshop, which we pledge to return to, despite its dusty and lackluster window display. At the end of the block, there is a big wooden building with rusty metal letters reading, mysteriously, "Papa Squat." By then, Libby's distracted by her phone, texting Brendan as she shuffles along beside me. She's still smiling, but it's a rigid expression, and it almost looks like she's on the verge of tears. Her stomach is growling, and her face is pink from the heat, and I can imagine her texts are something along the lines of, "Maybe this whole thing was a mistake," and a sudden desperation swells in me. I need to turn this around fast, starting with finding food. I stop abruptly beside the wooden building and peer into its tinted windows. Without looking up from her phone, Libby asks,
"Are you spying on someone?"
I'm looking into the window of Papa Squats. Her eyes lift slowly.
"What the hell is a Papa Squat?"
"Well," I point up at the sign, "it's either a very large public bathroom or a bar and grill."
"Why?"
Libby screams in a mix of delight and dismay, any remnant of her disappointment vanishing.
"Why does that exist?"
She plasters herself against the dark window, trying to see in. "I have no answers for you, Libby." I sidestep to haul one of the heavy wooden doors open. "Sometimes the world is a cruel, mysterious place. Sometimes people become warped, twisted, so ill at a soul level that they would name a dining establishment,
'Welcome to Papa Squat,'"
a curly-haired waif of a hostess says.
"How many are in your party?"
"Two, but we're eating for 5, Libby says.
"Oh, congratulations,"
the hostess says brightly, eyeing each of our stomachs whilst trying to perform an invisible math problem. "I don't even know this woman," I say, tipping my head toward Libby. "She's just been following me for 3 blocks.
"Okay, rude," my sister says. "It's been much more than 3 blocks. It's like you don't even see me."
The hostess seems uncertain. I cough. 2, please. She hesitantly waves toward the bar.
"Well, our bar is full service, but if you'd like a table, the bar's fine,"
Libby assures her. The hostess hands us each a menu that's about, 40 pages too long, and we slide onto pleather-topped stools, setting our purses on the sticky bar and scanning our surroundings in a silence driven by either shock or awe. This place looks like a Cracker Barrel had a baby with a honky-tonk, and now that baby is a teenager who doesn't shower enough and chews on his sweatshirt sleeves. The floors and walls alike are dark, mismatched wooden planks, and the ceiling is corrugated metal. Pictures of local sports teams are framed alongside "Home is where the food is" needlepoints and glowing Coors signs. The bar runs along the left side of the restaurant, and in one corner, a couple of pool tables are gathered, while in the corner opposite, a jukebox sits beside a shallow stage. There are more people in this one building than I've seen in the rest of Sunshine Falls combined, but still, the place manages to look desolate. I flip open the menu and start to peruse. Easily 30% of the listed items are just various deep-fried things. You name it, Papa Squat can fry it. The bartender, a preternaturally gorgeous woman with thick dark waves and a handful of constellation tattoos on her arms, comes to stand in front of me, her hands braced against the bar.
"What can I get you?"
Like the coffee shop slash horse farm guy, she looks less like a bartender than like someone who would play a bartender on a sexy soap opera. What's in the water here? Dirty martini, I tell her. Gin.
Soda water and lime, please,
Libby says. The bartender moves off, and I go back to skimming page 5 of the menu. I've made it to salads. Or at least that's what they're calling them, though if you put ranch dressing and Doritos on a bed of lettuce, I think you're taking liberties with the word. When the bartender returns, I try to order the Greek. She winces.
You sure?
Not anymore.
We're not known for our salads, she explains.
What are you known for? She waves a hand toward the glowing Coors Light sign behind her shoulder. What are you known for with regard to food? I clarify. She says,
to be known isn't necessarily to be admired. What do you recommend?
Libby tries.
Other than Coors. The fries are good, she says. Burger's okay.
Veggie burger? I ask. She purses her lips.
It won't kill you.
Sounds perfect, I say. I'll have one of those and some fries.
Same,
Libby adds. Despite her insistence that the burger won't kill us, the bartender's shrug reads, "Your funeral, bitches." Libby seems totally fine, happy even, but there's still a kernel of anxiety in my gut, and I accidentally drink my entire martini before our food arrives. I'm tipsy enough that everything's taking me longer than it should. Libby scarfs her burger down and hops up to use the bathroom before I've made a dent in mine. My phone vibrates on the sticky counter, and I'm 100% expecting it to be Charlie. It's a zillion times better. Dusty has finally turned in part of her manuscript, and not a minute too soon. Her editor goes out on maternity leave in a month. Thank you all so much for your patience. I know the schedule hasn't been ideal for you, but it means so much that you trust me enough to let me work in the way that serves me best. I have a complete first draft, but have only had a chance to clean and tighten this first bit. I hope to have several more chapters to you within the week, but hopefully this gives you an idea of what to expect. I tap open the attached document titled Frigid 1.0. It starts with chapter 1. Always a good sign that an author hasn't gone full Jack Torrance locked up with his typewriter in the Overlook. I resist the urge to scroll through to the end, a tic I've had since I was a kid, when I realized there were too many books in the world and not enough time. I've always used it as a litmus test for whether I want to read a book or not, but given that this is a client's work, I'm going to be reading the whole thing no matter what. So instead, my eyes skim over the first line, and it hits like a gut punch. They called her the shark. What the fuck? I say. An older man at the end of the bar jerks his head up from his watery soup and scowls. Sorry, I grumble, and train my eyes on the screen again. They called her the shark, but she didn't mind. The name fit. For one thing, sharks could only swim forward. As a rule, Nadine Winters never looked back. Her life was predicated on rules, many of which served to ease her conscience. If she looked back, she'd see the trail of blood. Moving forward, all there was to think about was hunger. And Nadine Winters was hungry. For a minute, I'm actually hoping to discover that Nadine Winters is a literal shark, that Dusty has written the talking animal story of Charlie Lastra's nightmares. But 4 lines down, a word jumps out as if, rather than Times New Roman, it's written in Curl Up and Die's blood-curdling font. Agent. Dusty's main character, the shark, is an agent. I backtrack to the word right before it. Film. Film agent, not literary agent. The differentiation does nothing to loosen the knot in my chest or to quiet the rush of blood in my ears. Unlike me, Nadine Winters has jet black hair and blunt bangs. Like me, She only skips heels when she's working out. Unlike me, she takes Krav Maga every morning instead of virtual classes on her Peloton. Like me, she orders a salad with goat cheese every time she eats out with a client and drinks her gin martinis dirty, never more than one. She hates any loss of control. Like me, she never leaves the house without a full face of makeup and gets bi-monthly manicures. Like me, she sleeps with her phone next to her bed, sound turned to full volume. Like me, she often forgets to say hello at the start of her conversations and skips goodbye at the end. Like me, she has money but doesn't enjoy spending it and would rather scroll through Net-a-Porter filling up her cart for hours than leave it that way until everything sells out. Nadine didn't enjoy most things, Dusty writes. Enjoyment was beside the point of life. As far as she could tell, staying alive was the point, and that required money and survival instincts. My face burns hotter with every page. The chapter ends with Nadine walking into the office right in time to see her two assistants giddily celebrating something. With a cutting glare, she says, "What?" Her assistant announces she's pregnant. Nadine smiles like the shark she is, says congratulations, then goes into her office, where she starts thinking through all the reasons she should fire Stacy, the pregnant assistant. She doesn't approve of distractions, and that's what pregnancy is. Nadine doesn't deviate from plans. She doesn't make exceptions to rules. She lives life by a strict code, and there's no room for anyone who doesn't meet it. In short, she is a puppy-kicking, kitten-hating, money-driven robot. The puppy-kicking is implied, but give it a few more chapters and it might become canon. As soon as I finish reading, I start over, trying to convince myself that Nadine, a woman who makes Miranda Priestly look like Snow White, isn't me. The third read-through is the worst of all, because this is when I accept that it's good. One chapter, 10 pages, but it works. I stand woozily and head toward the dark nook where the bathrooms are, rereading as I go. I need Libby now. I need someone who knows me, who loves me, to tell me this is all wrong. I should have been looking where I was going. I shouldn't have worn such high heels or had a martini on an empty stomach or been reading a book that's giving me a surreal, out-of-body experience. Because some combination of those poor decisions leads to me barreling into someone. And we're not talking about a casual, "Oh, I clipped you on the shoulder. How adorably clumsy I am." We're talking, "Holy shit, my nose!" Which is what I hear in the moment that my ankles wobble, my balance is thrown off, and my gaze snaps up to a face belonging to none other than Charlie Lastra. Right as I go down like a sack of potatoes. 6. Charlie catches my forearms before I can tumble all the way down, steadying me as the words, "What the hell?" fly out of him. After the pain and shock comes recognition, followed swiftly by confusion.
"Nora Stevens."
My name sounds like a swear. He gapes at me. I gape back. I blurt, "I'm on vacation." His confusion deepens. "I'm not stalking you." His eyebrows furrow.
"Okay."
"I'm not." He releases my forearms.
"More convincing every time you say it."
"My sister wanted to take a trip here," I say, "because she loves Once in a Lifetime." Something flutters behind his eyes. He snorts. I cross my arms. "One has to wonder why you'd be here."
"Oh," he says dryly, "I'm stalking you."
At my eye bulge, he says,
"I'm from here, Stevens."
I gawk at him in shock for so long that he waves a hand in front of my face.
"Hello? Are you broken?"
"You are from here? Like, here?
I wasn't born on the bar of this unfortunate establishment, he says, lip curled. If that's what you mean, but yes, nearby.
It's not computing. Partly because he's dressed like he just stepped out of a Tom Ford spread in GQ, and partly because I'm not convinced this place isn't a movie set that production abandoned halfway through construction. Charlie Lastra is from Sunshine Falls. His gaze narrows.
Did my nose go directly into your brain?
You are from Sunshine Falls, North Carolina, I say. A place with one gas station and a restaurant named Papa Squat.
Yes.
My brain skips over several more relevant questions to, is Papa Squat a person? Charlie laughs, a surprised sound so rough I feel it as a scrape against my ribcage.
No.
What, then, I say, is a Papa Squat? The corner of his mouth ticks downward.
I don't know. A state of mind?
And what's wrong with the Greek salad here?
You tried to order a salad?
He says.
Did the townspeople circle you with pitchforks?
Not an answer.
It's shredded iceberg lettuce with nothing else on it, he says. Except when the cook is drunk and covers the whole thing in cubed ham.
Why? I ask.
I imagine he's unhappy at home,
Charlie replies, deadpan.
Might have something to do with the kinds of thwarted dreams that lead a person to working here.
Not why does the cook drink, I say. Why would anyone cover a salad in cubed ham?
If I knew the answer to that, Stevens, he says, I'd have ascended to a higher plane.
At this point, he notices something on the ground and ducks sideways, picking it up.
This yours?
He hands me my phone.
Wow,
he says, reading my reaction.
What did this phone do to you?
It's not the phone, so much as the sociopathic super bitch who lives inside it. Charlie says,
most people just call her Siri.
I shove my phone back to him, Dusty's pages still pulled up. The furrow in his brow reforms, and immediately I think, what am I doing? I reach for the phone, but he spins away from me, the crease beneath his full bottom lip deepening as he reads. He swipes down the screen impossibly fast, his pout shifting into a smirk. Why did I hand this over to him? Is the culprit here the martini, the recent head injury, or sheer desperation?
It's good,
Charlie says finally, pressing my phone into my hand. That's all you have to say? I demand. Nothing else you care to comment on?
Fine, it's exceptional,
he says. It's humiliating, I parry. He glances toward the bar, then meets my eyes again.
Look, Stevens, this is the end of a particularly shitty day, inside a particularly shitty restaurant. If we're going to have this conversation, can I at least get a Coors?
You don't strike me as a Coors guy, I say.
I'm not,
he says.
But I find the merciless mockery from the bartender here dampens my enjoyment of a Manhattan.
I look toward the sexy TV bartender. Another enemy of yours? His eyes darken, his mouth doing that grimace twitch.
Is that what we are? Do you send all your enemies Bigfoot erotica or just the special ones?
Oh, no, I say, feigning pity. Did I hurt your feelings, Charlie?
You seem pretty pleased with yourself, he says, for a woman who just found out she was the inspiration for Cruella de Vil.
I scowl at him. Charlie rolls his eyes.
Come on, I'll buy you a martini, or a puppy coat.
A martini, exactly what Nadine Winters drinks whenever she doesn't have easy access to virgin's blood. For some reason, my ex-boyfriend Jacob flits into my mind. I picture him drinking beer from a can on his back porch, his wife curled under his arm, swigging on her own. Even four kids in, she's laid back and absurdly gorgeous, yet somehow one of the guys, the anti-Nora. They always are the women I get dumped for. Pretty hard to learn to be one of the guys when your entire experience with men growing up was either, one, them making your mother cry, or two, your mother's dancer friends teaching you how to step ball change.
I can be one of the guys, as long as the guys in question have a favorite song from Les Mis. Otherwise, I'm hopeless.
I'll have a beer, I say as I pass Charlie. And you're buying.
Like I said, he murmurs, following me to the peanut shell-strewn bar.
As he's exchanging pleasantries with the bartender, definitely not enemies, there's a vibe, by which I mean he's 15% less rude than usual. I glance back toward the bathroom, but Libby still hasn't emerged.
I don't even realize I've gone back to rereading the chapters until Charlie tugs my phone from my hands.
Stop obsessing.
I'm not obsessing. He studies me with that black hole gaze, the one that makes me want to scrabble for purchase.
I'm surprised this is such a problem for you.
And I'm shocked your artificial intelligence chip allows you to feel surprise.
Well, hello.
I flinch toward Libby's voice and find her smiling like a cartoon cat whose mouth is stuffed with multiple canaries.
Libby, I say, this is...
Before I can introduce Charlie, she pipes up.
Just wanted to let you know I called a cab. I'm not feeling well.
What's wrong? I start to rise, but she pushes my shoulder back down, hard.
Just exhausted.
She sounds anything but.
You should stay. You're not even done with your burger.
Lib, I'm not going to just let you.
Oh!
She looks at her phone.
Hardy's here. You don't mind getting the bill, do you, Nora?
I'm not traditionally a blusher, but my face is on fire because I've just realized what's going on, which means Charlie likely has too, and Libby's already retreating, leaving me with half a veggie burger, an unpaid bill, and a deep desire for the earth to swallow me whole. She throws a look over her shoulder and calls loudly,
"Good luck checking off number 5, sissy!"
"Number 5?"
Charlie asks as the door swings shut, vanishing my sister into the night. I really don't like the idea of her hiking up those steps alone. I snatch my phone back up and text her, "Let me know the second you make it up to the cottage or else." Libby replies, "Let me know the second you make it to third base with Mr. Hotman." Over my shoulder, Charlie snorts. I turn my phone away, squaring my shoulders. "That was my sister, Libby," I say. "Ignore everything she says. She's always horny when she's pregnant, which is always." His truly miraculous eyebrows lift, his heavy-lidded gaze homing in.
There is so much to unpack in that sentence.
And so little time. I bite into my burger just to focus on something other than his face. I should get back to her.
So no time for that beer.
He says it like a challenge, like, I knew it. His brow is arched, the tiniest shred of a smirk hiding in one corner of his mouth. Somehow, this doesn't totally extinguish his pout. It just makes it a smout. The bartender returns with our sweating glass bottles then, and Charlie thanks her. For the first time, I see her staggeringly incandescent smile.
Of course, she says. If you need anything, just say the word.
As she turns away, Charlie faces me, taking a long sip. Why do you get a smile? I demand. I'm a 30% minimum tipper.
Yeah, well, you should try almost marrying her and see if that helps,
he replies, leaving me so stunned I'm back to gawping. Speaking of sentences with a lot to unpack,
I know you're a busy woman, he says. I'll let you get back to sharpening your knives and organizing your poison cabinet, Nadine Winters.
He says everything so evenly, it's easy to miss the joke in it. But this time, the unmistakably cajoling note in his voice backcombs over me until I feel like a dog with its hackles up. First of all, I say, it's a pantry, not a cabinet, and second of all, the beer's already here, and it's after work hours, so I might as well drink it. Because I am not Nadine Winters. I grab my bottle and chug, feeling Charlie's owlish eyes heavy on me. He says,
"It's fucking good, right?"
For once, he lets a little excitement into his voice. His eyes flash like lightning just crackled through the inside of his skull.
"If
you're into cat pee and gasoline. The chapter, Nora.
My jaw tightens as I nod.
As far as I've seen, Charlie's eyebrows have three modes: brooding, scowling, and portraying something that's either concern or confusion. That's what they're up to now.
But you're still upset about it.
Upset? I cry. Just because my oldest client thinks I'd fire someone for getting pregnant? Don't be silly.
Charlie tucks one foot on the rung of his stool, his knee bumping mine.
She doesn't think that.
He tips his head back for another swig. A bead of beer snakes down his neck, and for a moment, I'm hypnotized, watching it cut a trail toward the collar of his shirt.
And even if she does, Charlie says, that doesn't make it true.
If she wrote a whole book about it, I say, it might make other people think it's true.
Who cares?
This guy, I point to my chest. The person who needs people to work with her in order to have a job.
How long have you been representing Dusty?
He asks. 7 years.